Hello, welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today we are staying in Brussels. It's very expensive going back and forth. As you know, actually, we're not in Brussels, but last week's episode, we interviewed Casa, and she was a great interview. And as you know, she is a lobbyist there in Brussels. And she introduced us to today's guest, Mark Dober, the managing partner of Dober Partners. And Mark has had an incredible career. He's originally from Great Britain and did a short stint in the British Army, and then went on to Hill Knowlton and then APCO. And we're going to hear all about that. And now he is a headhunter in Brussels. And so if any of our listeners are interested in finding a job lobbying or in public affairs in Brussels, Mark is the man. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jim. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. So, well, why don't we first start? Why don't you tell our listeners how you first got into lobbying? Because for most of us, it was not part of our plan and we fell into it. But I think how you fell into it is a bit unique.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Yes, it's true. I don't think lobbying was really one of those careers you found in a careers book at school. I seem to remember things like accountancy or law, but just lobbying wasn't there because there weren't many people doing it, certainly in my generation. It's something I happened into by accident. I learned politics and Portuguese in Brazil. So I did a master's in political science in Rio de Janeiro, which is not necessarily a place known for academic hard work, which is great because I don't think I was that academic, but I did love the beaches there and the lifestyle. And I came back to London, and by chance I found that Hill & Knowlton was looking for a Portuguese-speaking lobbyist to help them with an account that they'd just won, which was representing the MPLA government of Angola against Savimbi. I don't know if you remember, there was a very nasty civil war down there. And on one side was the US and CIA funding a nasty civil war down there with Jonas Savimbi, and I guess Russia and the Cubans were on the other side. But it had got to stalemate point, and we were employed by the government to really try and get a ceasefire and stop the CIA doing what they were doing down there, because there was some pretty awful murders and things like that going on. So I took journalists down there and showed what was really going on. And you know, from the Vietnam War and those kinds of things, the power of image. And I think when politicians in Washington saw what was going on and what they were supporting, they withdrew political support. And about a year and a half after working on that, at Hill & Knowlton, in offices in D.C. and London and Brussels, I think we managed to pull the plug. And so as a young man, I realized, wow, this works. Lobbying's very powerful. And so I decided to stick at it. And ever since, I've been a lobbyist or a headhunter of lobbyists.
And how often did you have to go back and visit the country? Did you go back and forth quite a bit? Or
yeah, I think I went there 3 times to Angola, if I remember correctly. There was one time I remember we went up to Cabinda, which is Angola's divided into 2 parts. There's a little enclave in the north, and the American oil companies have concessions there. And I was a bit apprehensive because apparently the helicopter that had gone just before, they'd come back with everybody with their ears cut off because there was an independence movement in Cabinda, and their tradition is if they don't like you, they cut your ears off. So I went up in a Russian military helicopter, one of those Hein gunships, and I sat in the proboscis at the front where they had a little machine gun nest as we kind of lurched over the African wildlife. That was something that's kind of burned in my memory. And we got there and we took the journalist there and we showed the situation on the ground and got the story.
Wow. Well, I don't think there's many people that have had their first job in lobbying to be so so intense and so important. And so how long did you spend at Hill & Knowlton? And then after that, you went to APCO?
Yeah, I spent 4 years at Hill & Knowlton doing everything from Procter & Gamble to Ford Motor Company type lobbying to a lot of African governments. And in Brussels, so I moved from London to Brussels. And I switched and actually ended up working for a lot of other African governments. For instance, the government of Uganda we worked, went up to the border of Sudan, and we were trying to get European Union money to prevent conflict there. And that was a fascinating assignment where we had to work as lobbyists alongside mercenaries for our security, but who were also looking to find peace in the border region with Sudan. So yeah, I've had some pretty unusual assignments, but that's the beauty of consultancy, right? You never know who's going to call and what project you're going to get called into.
Yeah, no, that's right. However, I don't think most of us are representing countries on the verge of civil war. So Mark, you, I think, carried a different specialty there. And so while you were still at Hill & Knowlton, you made the switch over to Brussels, and then you started up the office of APCO. Is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, I was employee number one, and we had grew a small team in year two. And then I hired somebody to work alongside me, a joint managing director, who is now CEO of APCO Worldwide, a very smart gentleman called Brad Staples. And so he leads the whole organization now.
Wow. And how many employees are there currently at APCO in Brussels?
Well, I'm no longer a shareholder since last year. But the last time I looked, I think there are about 700. So it's one of the very big firms in public affairs, and they've got some amazing smart lobbyists around the world.
700 total, and then how many in Brussels?
I think around 50 these days. So,
wow, and you were the first employee. You started the office.
Yeah. In the corner of a law firm office, we had I remember we didn't have much of a budget to buy computer hardware or table, so I had one wobbly desk in the corner of a law firm, and we scrapped for every client. And I think in consultancy, you do good work for one client and they recommend you to another client, and that's how you grow. And we were lucky, and we were a go-to agency in the 90s and stuck at it.
And do you think that was because of your work? I mean, do you think that's the best way to get clients is to do good work?
I think so. I think there's been research on that subject that the easiest work to expand is your current client base, right? So get a deeper relationship with your current clients and then work within their network of recommendations, really. So same with plumbing or brain doctors or whatever it may be, right? You want to know the best, you ask around. It's a lot about reputation and trust.
Well, but in those beginning days at APCO, I mean, you were just one or two people. So how do you get hired? You're obviously competing against bigger firms back then. How do you get hired?
Well, just good people, really, having good, smart people around me. I don't think there's any other secret, because in a consultancy, that's all you're hiring. I guess we were quite aggressive and fearless and gung-ho, the energy of youth. we weren't afraid. Yeah. We had something to prove. I remember a lot of I was only 26 when I started APCO in Brussels. And thankfully, Marjorie Krausen put a lot of trust in me to get the business off the ground, and it worked. But I'm sure there were a lot of people thinking, she must be crazy to invest in that guy. And there were a lot of old guys in Brussels who were saying, that's never going to work. Who's that kid, you know, which drove me on. You know, I had something to prove. And so I think that, you know, energy of youth, having something to prove will get you a long way.
Yeah, well, and prove you did. And so at some point, before we move on from that, what is it, and we heard last week a little bit of what it's like, what is it like lobbying in Brussels? And as we learned last week, there's probably more lobbyists in Brussels than there are in Washington, D.C., which is saying something.
Well, I used to be a lobbyist in London very early in my career. And what I found refreshing coming to Brussels is it's much more of a what you know than who you know kind of place. So being a subject matter expert is really important. It's quite a technical town. So yes, of course, there are politics, and it is three-dimensional chess, because you know, you've got 27 countries competing for decisions going their way. You've also got the European Parliament, you've got the European Commission, and then you've got all these lobbyists and NGOs and associations. So we're all speaking tons of different languages, coming from completely different political cultures, you know, from former East Germany, Poland, to former dictatorships like Portugal or Spain. So it's a very unique place. It's a very multinational environment. English, thankfully, is still the working language. I don't know for how long, because I don't think the French are very happy about that now that the UK has left. But it's a fascinating place. And I don't think it's a very corrupt place. It's pretty fair and transparent. that we don't have the equivalent of political action committees, and there's not the same money around politics or political campaigning that there is in the US. It's quite a different system.
Yeah, it is a different system. And as you mentioned, you know, here in the US, you have 50 states, but they're all part of the same country. You have 27 different entities. Yeah. I can't even imagine what that is like. Well, hopefully if they switch from English, they go to Portuguese.
That would be nice, yeah.
Or, that would be nice for you.
Or move to Portugal, that would be even nicer. The weather's much better there than it is in Brussels.
In Brussels.
Although we do have good chocolate and beer here, as you probably heard.
Yes, I have heard. So you leave that and you jump into headhunting.
Mm.
Why'd you make the change to become a headhunter?
I think, well, it's funny. Again, it was an accident, right? After 15, 16 years at ABCO, I was thinking, what next? And so I talked to a few headhunters. And funnily enough, one of them offered basically my old job back at Hill & Knowlton, where it started. And I thought, oh, no, I can't do that.
Can't go backwards.
Yeah, right. Somebody talked to me about running the Venture Capital Association, which sounded quite interesting and lucrative. And then a headhunting firm said, why didn't you come and work with us? And I thought, wow, that's an interesting idea. I'd never thought about that. But I guess headhunting was not a totally alien concept to me, because recruitment is such an important part of growing an agency, right? It's hiring people, you know, smarter, better than me, and making an environment where they can prosper and thrive and do good work for clients. So I think I'd always had a little bit of an eye for talent and always enjoyed that bit of the business. So voila, as we say, here I'm a headhunter.
And what firm did you join when you went into headhunting?
Yeah, so I joined a UK-based headhunting firm called Elwood Atfield. And when I looked up headhunting, actually there's a book on headhunting written by The Economist. And what it said was, for the European marketplace, 50% of all headhunting businesses are based in the UK. And they used to do, they would call into Belgium or into France, and they would place people in senior jobs, because the UK apparently is a very good country for that. But actually, I think as other markets got more sophisticated, and obviously Brussels is a very different place from London, and although they're only separated by a small channel of water, they're very different cultures, different languages, etc. Frankly, they were not best placed to, you know, headhunt senior positions based in Brussels. They didn't really walk and talk in the corridors of power in Brussels. So many of the UK-based headhunting firms wanted to set up Brussels offices. So I set up the Brussels office for Elwood Atfield and ran that for 10 years, happily so, and left to do my own business. I Brexited the other way around from a UK business and took my team and expanded it, and been doing very well, surprisingly well in the pandemic, because we launched on 1st of April last year, which apart from being April Fool's Day, I don't know if you have that tradition in the States.
We do.
Right. It was also one of the worst days for news headlines on the pandemic, and we were in total lockdown. We couldn't even go to the end of our street, basically. But actually, we prospered, and the phones haven't stopped ringing, and we've been hiring a huge amount of lobbyists, partly because the consultancy sector has been booming. Corporations have needed to speak to the EU and governments like never before, and similarly for trade associations. So, you know, these are all of our, you know, client segment groups.
So the first year on your own has been pretty good.
Best financial year I've ever had, yeah. And I am surprised. I wouldn't have expected that a year ago. I was very worried that I wouldn't be sitting here with you talking about a successful year.
I bet. I can only imagine. And so you obviously have hired not only at the APCO when you were running the office, but as a headhunter, you have probably hired or interviewed more lobbyists than maybe anybody we've spoken to.
Mm.
So what insights can you tell us? What do you look for and what have you learned?
Mm. Well, it really depends on who I'm looking for. So for instance, for a director general, we would call them over here, or secretary general of a trade association, I might be looking for different things from a senior corporate lobbyist or a senior consultant. But there are some personality attributes I look across for whatever segment the lobbyists work for. So I've done quite a bit of background reading and academic research on personality attributes, for instance. And I don't know if you know the big five personality attributes. Have you heard of that? Ocean. There's openness. So ocean stands for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And if you can imagine, everybody somewhere on that scale, right? Some people are more introvert or extrovert. And the combination of those things gives us a unique personality. And actually, one thing I learned is, do you know what age are your personalities fully formed by, Jim? Have a guess.
What age? Fully formed. I would say 16.
16, yeah. I actually thought it was 6, but actually the research shows 35.
35,
so,
okay.
You still got, if you're under 35, you've still got a chance to change your personality. But after that, it's basically pretty deep-seated. So what you see is what you get.
there's no changing it?
Yeah. No, not really. And I think what I've learned over the years, particularly as a headhunter, is, you know, knowledge and skills gets you to the table. And obviously, you need those to interview for any job, to be effective in any job. But it's personality that really sets apart the great lobbyists. And the kinds of things that I look for are subsets of those personality attributes, the ones I just talked about, ocean. So for me, for instance, trustworthiness is probably number one. And trustworthiness is interesting. Do you know what kind of people are trustworthy, Jim? What kind of people are trustworthy?
I don't know.
Well, interestingly, the research says cynical, skeptical people are not trustworthy, right? So isn't that interesting? So, you know, if you don't tend to trust other people, you're very skeptical about them, people won't tend to trust you. They might think you've got ulterior motives, right? So, and actually, as I learned that, I thought, apparently people trust me a lot. They tell me all kinds of secrets and they stay with me. But that's my natural philosophy. I tend to trust people and I'm very open about that. And I prefer to start from that point of view and be disappointed afterwards. So trustworthiness is not, don't be cynical or skeptical if you want to be more trusted. Try and be a bit more open and trusting yourself. And trustworthiness works both ways. I remember an interesting conversation with a senior member of the European Parliament. And I was asking him, you know, who are the top lobbyists? And he said, well, the people that I can trust. Because I need to know as a politician that I'm not just being set up for a fall. I need to know. And I want a long-term relationship with this person. I know if they're going to give me an amendment or an insight from industry, or they're going to give me a fact and present it as a fact, and I trust that it's a fact, then I need to trust them as a human being. I need to look them in the eye and trust them. And I think it goes the other way around as well. I mean, for instance, if you're a leader of a trade association, your members need to trust that person, right? That you're going to go out and advocate a fair and balanced position on behalf of the whole industry, for instance. So trustworthiness is extremely important in lobbying, particularly given the lack of, you know, public trust, the cynicism, the attention, the scrutiny over the whole sector anyway. But also things like resilience, I think, is extremely important. And there are certain industry sectors where that's particularly important. I know, for instance, I remember talking to a tobacco lobbyist, and in their annual reviews, resilience is one of the factors that they look at for performance. Because obviously, you know, if you're in that kind of industry or many, many others, you have to be used to being slapped down, told no, and you have to get up again and soldier on. And another one that I'm particularly aware of is agreeableness, which is one of those big five personality traits. So as you know from your personal life, some people are agreeable and some people are less agreeable, right? But what amazed me as I came into headhunting and I really started thinking about this and looking around is, wow, that industry has chosen to hire a really disagreeable leader for their trade association who manages to upset all of these politicians. And I can think of one particular example. Unfortunately, I can't say the name, but this leader of a trade association had so upset the European commissioner that she decided to go after that industry and imposed a piece of legislation that cost them hundreds of millions of euros. Because as policymakers, you always have choices, right? So she had three, you've only got limited resources. You can't go after everyone all the time. But this person had got so much in her face, she decided to go after that industry. And so I learned, you know, that can be very personal. It can cost you a lot of money. And it can also cost you reputation.
And so, wow, there's so much to unpack there. You know, it's first, it's very interesting what you say about being trustworthy, because it's just the opposite of how the industry is perceived. And one theme of this show is I've heard it over and over again, how different lobbyists, successful lobbyists, mostly down in Washington, D.C., have said that, you know, they maintain a very trustworthy relationship with the people they're interacting with. And part of that entails when they go in and they're asking for, let's say, an amendment, telling the politician, this is what the other side will say about why not to do this. And they can argue and almost lobby both sides. And it's just interesting that the perception is just the opposite, you know?
Yeah.
It's just very, very different. Why do you think someone who is disagreeable would end up in that position?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think people hire disagreeable people all the time. It's perhaps, I hope it's more of a thing of the past, because certainly as a young man, I seem to remember a lot more disagreeable people in leadership positions. But I think they still exist. There are people who are, you know, for our gender, we might call them alpha males, right? You know, there's the who doesn't listen much and is very assertive and can be very aggressive and through force of personality can get into a leadership position. And in lobbying, sometimes in industries where they're looking for someone to defend their industry right to the last man, defend, push back. What do they want? They're looking for a strong personality. But that person, in having strength of character, might also be highly disagreeable. And so I think I've seen it in trade associations particularly, where they've chosen someone who perhaps also was an industry expert, but not necessarily very good at the interpersonal stuff. So you asked about what do I look for in my candidates? I've talked about personality. I think if you look at skills and knowledge, if you run a trade association, for instance, what I've noticed over the years is if you're overly authoritarian, that doesn't work. If you tell people, right, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. No. Your members are paying you to deliver a service, you know, to defend their interests. So you can't be too authoritarian with them and nor with the secretariat. Otherwise, it will backfire. They sometimes call it like herding cats, I think, in trade association parlance, where you've gently got to coax people towards reaching common positions and gently coax them towards common actions that are in everybody's interest. So you need diplomatic skills, which also touches on personality. You know, some people are less diplomatic or more diplomatic. But you also have to have a highly strategic mindset, I think, if you're in a trade association leader, because it's your day job to help set the strategy for a whole sector or industry, because the board typically have their own day jobs. You know, they're CEOs of companies or they're top lobbyists of major Fortune 500 companies. So they've got other things to do than manage the trade association on a daily basis. They might engage in the strategy and discuss it with the trade association leader, finesse it. That's not their principal job.
I've heard it described here on this podcast. One person described it as a combination when he's hiring of how are they with people, public policy, politics, and their personality. And you also, and that seems very similar to what you look at. You mentioned personality. When you think of the right personality, are there some common traits that you think of, or does it depend on the job, as you were just saying? Or,
well, I think those ones I just mentioned, trustworthiness, resilience, agreeableness, are ones that come front of center. And I've written about that, and you can go to my website and have a look on the insight section, and you'll find some reports I've touched on this subject. But again, knowledge and skills, it really depends on the organization. So in consultancies, taking another group, there, new business is really important, right? If you're a senior consultant, if you're not good at winning new business, then you're in the wrong business. You should do something else. Maybe you should be an in-house lobbyist where you don't have to win new business. So it really depends on the sector and then on the organization. But generally, to be a good lobbyist, you know, you need to be persuasive. You need to be likable. I was reading that old book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know that? If you haven't read that for a while, look it up again. There's some real gems and pearls of wisdom in there.
From Dale Carnegie?
Yeah, exactly. Which apparently has never been out of print since 1931 or whenever it was first written. Yeah. And it's remarkable how fresh it still is as a book. But there was one thing that struck me recently rereading it was being likable, actually, going back to the point about agreeableness. If people don't like you, they won't be persuaded by you. You know, if you're a lobbyist and you're trying to persuade someone, if they don't like you, they could well take an opposite position.
But that's what I'm trying to get at. So if you have, like, you think about different lobbyists, there are some lobbyists who have really big personalities and tell stories, and they're very likable, and people want to be around them. On the other hand, there are lobbyists that are much quieter, much more thoughtful, but also very likable. And so they're both very different, both very likable. So they must have some common trait that makes people comfortable to be around them.
I used to think that being an extrovert was key to being an effective lobbyist. And I was corrected on that idea in a very public place where I presented that as an idea by the president of European Center for Public Affairs. So we had two organizations which represent lobbyists here from a sort of academic and thought leader position. We have the Public Affairs Council, which you will know, which has an office in Brussels, and European Center for Public Affairs. In fact, one of my colleagues at Dover Partners is also the executive director of that organization. But the president of the European Center for Public Affairs said, I disagree. You can also be a very good lobbyist and an introvert. I'm one. And there you go. She was the president, so she must be right. And I've reflected on that ever since. And she is right. There are a lot of great lobbyists who are introverted. They're not the type that like going out to do cocktail parties, you know. So I think in any diversity is a word which means many things to many people these days. But I know in Brussels, at least, it's not just about diversity of nationalities, of gender. It's also of personalities, right? So in a lobbying team, it's no bad thing to have some extroverts and some introverts, some people who are analysts and some people who are outgoing and are going break down some doors and get to meet people and deliver arguments, right? So I write about that in my book, High Performance Secretariat. So you can download that for free as well.
Well, we will include that in the show notes. We'll have a link to that. And yeah, I think there are certain traits that both the extrovert and the big storyteller and the introvert both have. They're both probably great listeners. They both probably ask questions. You know, even the person who is telling the big stories is probably also giving other people a chance to feel part of the conversation or discussion. But it's very, you're right, there's very many different types that can all be very agreeable.
Well, you mentioned a key word there, I think, listening. I think being an active listener in lobbying is really important. I like to tell candidates, remember during this interview, you have two organs for listening, your two ears, and one for talking. And maybe think about the proportion of those.
I like that. So now let's talk about Best in Brussels. When did you start that, and tell our listeners all about it?
I think I first had the idea for Best in Brussels in the 1990s, because we used to have a ranking for the Brussels agencies. And I always wanted to be number one. And I used to work for the number two. Actually, it was the number one ranked agency by revenue, which I guess traditionally has been the measure for saying you're the best, because you're the biggest, you're the best, right? And there's a logic to that. That means that there's certain, that clients are buying your services more than anybody else, right? And it's clear, it's numerical. So who can argue with that? Then you may remember a piece of legislation from you guys, actually, Sarbanes-Oxley, which meant that companies like WPP and Omnicom that owned all these lobbying agencies could no longer divide out their income. I think it had to do something with cooking the books or whatever they were doing. So all of a sudden, we didn't have these rankings or by revenue, because every agency was keeping their revenue secret. So somebody had the great idea, if you go to the National Bank of Belgium, you can see how much everyone's declared in terms of their billings for the year. So then we realized that that wasn't an accurate measure either, because people were doing all kinds of interesting tax arrangements. Or was that work lobbying, or was it really public relations? Was it Belgian work? What was it? Or were they billing for Microsoft across multiple jurisdictions, but how much of that was really Brussels business? So that wasn't an accurate measure either. Meanwhile, the only other place that you could find who actually does lobbying in terms of consultancies in Brussels was something perhaps your previous podcaster touched on, the Transparency Register. So there, I think we took a leaf out of your book in Washington, and so we developed this register over here. But frankly, if you go to that, it's a mess. It's like 280 consultancies are listed there, but it doesn't tell you really who they are or what they do. And at that time, three or four years ago, I was getting asked almost on a weekly basis by clients, so big Fortune 500 companies, trade associations, NGOs, lawyers, they were asking me, you're a headhunter, Mark, you can help us. Who are the top lobbyists in financial services? Who are the top healthcare guys, et cetera, et cetera? And so I would tell them, but it was my subjective opinion. And I thought, hang on a second, there's nowhere for them. And actually, I should be a little bit more scientific about this. Let me do something. Let me do some serious piece of research. And so I came up with this idea, which today is represented on the website bestinbrussels.eu, which you can visit for free. There's a free to download 200-page guide that comes out every year there in terms of the top consultancies and law firms and services for clients, also the top consultants themselves, or the people who are actually doing the lobbying. And it's really intended as a bridge between the service providers and the clients. I've been careful not to rank them in who's the very best, but I do give a methodology in terms of how they're on that list. And it has to do with some basic metrics, which include things like longevity, client relationships, reputation in the marketplace, etc. So there is a methodology behind it, but it also has to do with size. So we list out the top 75 lobbying consultancies in Brussels. And if you go to the website, you can click on the links and you'll get information about them.
What year was that first?
3 years ago, 2019. I thought I'd give it a go. I didn't know whether it would work, but actually it's gone from strength to strength. I think quite a few people were skeptical at start. So I probably got about half of the market in year one. Year two, I probably got about 75%. And this year, I think I've got about 95% of the market are participating because they all see the value.
And is it a separate entity, or and how much is it taking less and less of your time or more and more time?
Well, once a year, it takes a lot of time when I have to write this 200-page guide. And this year, what we did was we have a list of the 200 top lobbyists in Brussels, and you can see all their personal profiles there online. And I thought, wow, this is an interesting group. I mean, combined, they have literally thousands of years of Brussels lobbying experience. Wouldn't it be good to survey them once a year on something of common interest? So this year, we asked them about lobbying in the pandemic. We asked them also about who they think are the top in-house lobbyists. So who's the best trade association, the best company. Interestingly, this year they voted for Microsoft. Microsoft has done very well, I think, particularly in the tech sector, where other companies have got a lot more regulatory scrutiny. So they seem to have done well. The American Chamber of Commerce did very well as a trade association, and Transparency International was voted the top NGO.
Well, it's very interesting, and we'll include a link to that in the show notes. And that's quite an undertaking for you.
Yes.
And hopefully it'll get a little easier going forward.
I hope so. Constant updates, I think, because the market moves. And I guess it's the same in the US, but this market has grown hugely. When I arrived in 1993, there were 10,000 lobbyists based in Brussels. And now we're 2021, and there are over 25,000 lobbyists. So that's a significant growth. Huh?
Incredible. Incredible. Mm. Now, what are some of your hobbies? What's some of the things you do to keep yourself in shape and keep busy?
Well, I'm not as good a shape as I used to be before COVID, unfortunately, but I guess I'm not alone in that. Now, at the moment, I play like playing tennis and going for a bike ride. In the old days before COVID, I used to like beating people up and doing martial arts, but I'm not allowed to do that anymore.
Legally beating people up.
Yes. Yeah, but yeah, between consenting adults. Yeah.
So you are a kickboxing champion?
I was, yes. In 2002, I won the European Kickboxing Championship by knockout, in fact, technical knockout. He threw in the corner, threw his tail in the corner, yeah. So I used to be in Jean-Claude Van Damme's kickboxing club here in Brussels. When I came to Brussels as a young man, I thought, well, what do I do in this town? I don't know if you remember, in the 90s, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme was a big deal. I thought,
very big deal.
And I used to, yes, used to box, and I used to do judo. So I thought, oh, I'll try that. And so I met Van Damme and I met his trainer, and his trainer took me under his wing, and we became a team of fighters that would go around Europe and get in a ring. So after work, I would pack my boxing gloves and go and train. I haven't done that for a while, though, because I had my last fight age 40, and I was fighting a young man who's probably 26. It was a draw, but I saw stars, and I think it was a kind of wake-up moment, thinking, time to pack up my boxing gloves. So I mostly kick bags these days rather than human being.
Well, the fact that you did it until 40 is incredible. What type of martial arts have you done?
Well, these days, so I had to do, you know, when I gave up kickboxing, it was a bit difficult to do, I don't know, badminton or swimming or something. So in the gym, there was these guys also doing something called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, where you've seen it. And if you've seen UFC or cage fighting, after that, people beat the hell out of each other standing up, they normally end up on the ground and try and break each other's arms or strangle each other. So that's what Jiu-Jitsu is. It's the strangling people bit.
Got it,
and
yes.
And throwing them on the ground.
Yes. Well, I'm sure the fact that you did it till 40 is incredible, and I'm sure tennis is much easier.
Well, I'm still doing jiu-jitsu, but so every year I do the European Championship, and that I haven't won it for a long time, but I did win that in 2011.
Wow!
But, no, you can. That's the nice thing about jiu-jitsu. You can't keep training kickboxing in your 50s, but lots of old guys still doing jiu-jitsu in their 50s. So
okay.
I used to train four times a week until last summer, and then unfortunately it became an illegal activity in Belgium, so because you're in close contact. But I just got my Pfizer vaccine. Thank you, America. Thank you, Germany. And my intention is I'll be back there training jiu-jitsu again with my friends very soon.
Well, that's great. And Mark, it has been great to have you on.
Thank
and
you.
Great to hear about your business and everything Brussels. We wish you all the best, and we hope things in Brussels open up soon. For our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also sign up for our email, which comes out on Mondays, comes out with the show. You can do that at thepoliticallife.com. We hope you all have a safe week, and we will see you next Monday.